I'm William O'Flaherty, and this is a special edition of my podcast show called All About Jack. Who is Jack, you may ask? Well, that's the nickname of C.S. Lewis. He happened to be a very good friend of J.R.R. Tolkien, whose book The Hobbit we've been discussing with the author of The Christian World of The Hobbit. Before saying hello to Dr. Devin Brown, let me first welcome back Serena Higgins, who is sharing co-hosting duties with me for this fifth and final series of programs.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Devin Brown, as I mentioned, is once again with us to pass on his thoughts about a book that at the time of this recording is a soon-to-be-released movie, or at least the first of three movies. Thanks for being here again, Devin.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, now, this final show is exploring your fifth and last chapter of The Christian World of The Hobbit. It's entitled Response and Legacy, so a natural place to kick things off is to ask about the initial response to The Hobbit during Tolkien's day in the late 1930s.
Yeah, and I don't know if people know this, but 75 years ago, this strange book about hobbits, and it's hard to get back to that day where no one had ever heard of what a hobbit was, and get back to this idea where C.S. Lewis writes a review in the New York Times about this book called The Hobbit, and it's by this unknown, obscure Oxford professor named J.R.R. Tolkien. I mean, those names are now household words, but they weren't back then. The Hobbit took off and was a modest success, nothing like what it's gone on to be, but enough so that the publisher asked for a sequel, and people know the publishing history. Tolkien kind of started and stumbled on a sequel. What could he say more about Bilbo? What else could Bilbo do? And before you knew it, it wasn't going to be about Bilbo at all. It turned into The Lord of the Rings, a story about his nephew, Frodo, which had a different tone, a different scope, and kind of a different range. And even those didn't take off for a while. They thought they were going to lose money on them. And I got to tell you, this idea that they weren't sure this was going to really make money tells you that at the end of the day, publishers don't know quite as much as they want you to think they know.
And you actually begin your book with a quick overview of the legacy of The Hobbit, of sales and so forth. So the legacy has been astonishing, hasn't it?
Yes, it's surpassed anybody's wildest dreams. Of course, looking back now, we can say all sorts of things. It was written with a skill that other people didn't have, with a depth. You know, Tolkien thought a lot about what he wanted this kind of story to do. He's got a whole famous lecture on fairy tales. And then, of course, it was refined by some of the best minds in the world, the Inklings there, and, you know, stewed over for lots of years. So looking back, it's not so surprising. I guess the other element that I always think about is each generation has its own special kind of stories, these kind of stories that tell us who we are, what's important to us while we're here, and captures in story form the things that our culture both values and needs. And so my little formula is to say one reason why it's been so popular, both The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, and as well as Lewis's stories, is because they've been so deeply needed.
Now, these stories do tap into the deep cultural questions of their time and ours, but there's one potential problem with The Hobbit that Tolkien himself noted and C.S. Lewis talked about, and this is the idea of, is The Hobbit actually too scary for kids?
Yeah, and I guess what's funny, you mentioned about when it first came out, and in its early years, people were, from our perspective, overly worried about it being too frightening for children. I mean, compared to some of the things out there today, you don't hear that question very often. But nevertheless, when you read the book, there are some scary moments. There are also some quite sad moments, you know, when he's fighting the spiders on his own, or when Bilbo's down there in the beneath the misty mountains, and Gollum's down there. It's a pretty spooky little scene there. It's quite frightening, and of course quite sorrowful that his dear friend Thorin dies at the end. I mean, you go back and look at those, and you will see that they have been crafted to not be the sort of fear that's not really scary, or the pain that doesn't really hurt. It's the real deal. And Tolkien said that a safe fairyland would be untrue to both worlds. And I love that quote, because he really captures something there. Chesterton went on to argue that fairy tales don't give the child the idea or of the possibility of evil. They already know about that. They already know what happens when you turn off the lights in the bedroom and what might be there. These stories give young readers the idea that there's something more powerful than those things that go bump in the night.
Another aspect you discuss specifically in this chapter 5 of The Christian World of the Hobbit is the question of why there are scenes of such bitter sadness in a book initially aimed for kids.
Yeah, and I would add to that, though, there is great sadness, right? There's death here and loss. And even when Bilbo comes home, his close friends in the Shire don't even want to recognize he's come back because they want his stuff. They want Bag End, his relatives there. There's a lovely line from The Lord of the Rings, "In sorrow we must go, but not in despair." And man, that little tiny sentence, "In sorrow we must go, but not in despair," really is what Tolkien wants to say and what makes him different from the other postmodern writers. I'm saying would say, "In sorrow we must go," and well, that's all there is. But Tolkien extends that. Yes, there is sorrow, but that's not the end of the story. He doesn't end it there. He ends with the opposite of despair, with renewal. I mean, take a look at the desolation of Smaug. I mean, it's not for no purpose that he doesn't end with Frodo arriving home. He gets Frodo home and has Gandalf and Balin come visit him a year later, and he tells him what's happened there, right? The desolation's now filled with birds and blossoms and fruit and feasting, and the Lake Town friends are all getting along, and this is part of what you've done. Yes, there was real pain and real sorrow, but it didn't end in that, and it paid off in something much, much greater than that, and something that's going to extend beyond that.
Now, there have been other criticisms of Tolkien's work besides that critique that it might be too scary for children, and you observe in your book that actually The Lord of the Rings has been more popular with ordinary readers rather than with literary scholars. And you mentioned another specific comment from the author Tom Shippey about why Tolkien is often unpopular with critics.
Yeah, I mean, as an English teacher, I'm part of this debate, and I must say maybe it's gotten a little bit better. I was at a Tolkien conference talking to some really sharp English professors at snazzy universities, and a woman there said to me, she said, if we're around in 50 years, you should look for Tolkien be included in the Norton Anthology of British Literature, this idea that the canon, which has been closed so tightly against Christian authors, against fantasy authors, that people are going to rethink that. You know, in poll after poll, Tolkien is always picked as one of the greatest writers of the 20th century among ordinary people. Not true with most English professors. When I went and did my graduate work, there was no class in Tolkien. Well, that's probably going to change at some point, but not soon enough for most of us.
Something you mentioned, but we didn't really discuss in any detail in your fourth chapter, but you do go into more detail here in the fifth and final one, is Tolkien's essay entitled On Fairy Stories, you point out, was written not long after The Hobbit, and it contains various points relevant to what's been said already. You note that he talks about three functions, recovery, escape, and consolation. Could you share about the important points that he discusses?
Yeah, and we could talk, a whole hour on that whole On Fairy Stories. It's a very complicated, and I'll just say convoluted. If you've ever read it, you know what I'm talking about. It's a wandering talk. But yeah, the idea of recovery, fairy stories, according to Tolkien, help us to see the things of our world, well, as we were meant to see them, with wonder, right, instead of triteness, to see them afresh. And I think he does a great job of that. The second one that you mentioned, that he mentions, escape, is a great one because, man, critics want to label that in the bad sense, where escape just takes us away from the negative things in the world. We get to flee them like a crutch, right? Well, let me just tell you this. There's plenty of distress, disappointment, and problems in Middle Earth. Matter of fact, I think Middle Earth has more of those than ours does sometimes, right? So Tolkien doesn't take it to this lovely fairyland where everything's wonderful. He said this. He said, when I talk about the escape of fairy tales, and not just his own, but in general, he has this interesting metaphor. He says, imagine people swimming under a glass roof at a swimming pool. He said, that's what modern literature is like, and I would say postmodern. And he says, fairy tales, peel back that roof and let us get to the big ocean. And that's one of my favorite ones. And of course, consolation, I don't know that anybody has seen The Lord of the Rings or finished reading it or will see The Hobbit or finished reading and doesn't have what Tolkien calls a lifting of the heart, a fleeting glimpse of joy that comes from beyond the walls of the world. So yeah, that's the consolation they provide. And I think he's exactly right.
There are two other very important words for Tolkien's theories about fantasy and fairy stories. And you mentioned these as well. And they are subcreation and eucatastrophe. Could you define those two words?
Yeah, again, this is something we could talk lots and lots about. But in a nutshell, the subcreation is this. Tolkien says this, if we are created in the image of God, God is a maker, and so man at his highest point is meant to be a maker. And I think a lot of people agree with this, that what makes us different from the rest of creation is our creativity, our imagination, our urge deep down to be creative and make something. Now, when we make something, We don't make it out of nothing like God did. And the analogy that made sense to me when I was first learning about this was just like a builder doesn't make the wood. He's given the wood, but he makes the house out of it. In that sense, Tolkien would look at all artists and not just writers, but I think musicians and potters and any kind of creative person as sub-creators. God has created the world, and we are sub-creators when we make something out of the materials that are there. The other word you mentioned, eucatastrophe, is a word that Tolkien coined, but that hasn't really taken off like some of his other creations. It's the opposite of catastrophe, right? Where you have a tragic end. Instead of ending in tragedy and sorrow, what we end in faith and hope.
Devin, going to another topic here for a moment, you quote a very interesting thing that Tolkien said when some people were talking about illustrating or setting his stories. He said that would be fine as long as he had the ability to veto anything from or influenced by the Disney studios. And this also reminds me, as a side note, that C.S. Lewis was very upset when he was talking to someone about films of the Narnia Chronicles, because he said it would be blasphemous to represent Aslan in anything like the Disney way. So that brings up this topic of the film. So are you looking forward to the Hobbit movie? Are you trepidatious about it? Are there any particular scenes you're looking forward to watching?
Yeah, well, yes. This is another topic we could talk about, the three of us, for probably 30 minutes, but I'll give you my short version of that. One, of course, is when Lewis and Tolkien were mentioning Disney, I don't think they meant the Disney of today. Disney of today is a whole different story, and I think they do a pretty great job with certain kinds of stories. But it was the Disney that sanitized everything, took out the real pain, took out the real sorrow, and maybe the Disney of our youth. When it comes to seeing The Hobbit, you know, I look at the trailers quite a bit and talk with my Hobbit buddies about them. Having said that, I'm not going to go at midnight. I'm a little too old for that. I'll probably see it the next day really early unless I get invited to an early show. And I'm really looking forward to how they do the beginning and the end. You know, this idea, we talked about it on the show, is that Bilbo was chosen. Well, there's a line that Gandalf has in one of the trailers, because he gives me courage. And I'll accept that. But he wasn't really chosen to give Gandalf courage. He was chosen for not just for that reason. And I hope they do that part right. And then, of course, curious how they do the very last line that Gandalf has to say. And why you don't really suppose, do you, that all your adventures and escapes were managed by mere luck. And Mr. Baggins' last line is, well, thank goodness. Well, I'm hoping they get those lines right. You know, Peter Jackson did a good job with The Lord of the Rings. Everyone's got their quibbles, but I think mostly they are quibbles. And so I'm looking forward to seeing The Hobbit in movies, as I'm sure most people listening to this are.
Well, I'm sorry to say it's time to end not only this show, but the entire series on your book, The Christian World of The Hobbit. Personally, let me note that as someone who really has only read The Hobbit a few times and only here in the last few years, that your book has been very helpful to me personally, and I think those who are even more familiar with it will enjoy it as well. It's not meant to be a super analytical thing, but I think it's a nice perspective, and your title clearly notes you're looking at the Christian world of The Hobbit in various aspects. So hopefully we've sparked an interest in you, the listener, in getting Devin Brown's book. Well, speaking of books, Devin, you noted it last time, but let's note it again for those who are listening to this before it comes out. In 2013, which is the 50th anniversary of C.S. Lewis's death, you have another project coming out related to him.
Yes. 2013 seems to be one of those magical years. We look back and we say, well, 50 years ago, that's a lot of time, basically. And looking back from this point, 5 decades later, what might we say about Lewis that hasn't already been said? And that's a good point to add, because there's a number of fine biographies. And I kind of discovered that, oddly enough, his spiritual life, his spiritual journey has not been explored totally. Let's just say that I found lots of new things that I thought were interesting and new things to say. So in 2013, my book, A Life Observed, A Spiritual Biography of C.S. Lewis, will come out. And if people like The Christian World and The Hobbit, I think that's the kind of book they might like as well.
Now, are we looking, is the date floated around, or is it going to be late 2013, early 2013?
Yeah, right now they're looking for a summer release. You know, he died in November, so I think they want to have it out there because we're expecting a really renewed interest in Lewis in November of 2013, because he dies in November 63, same day as JFK. So it'll be out in the summer, and with the idea that interest will really grow and peak, you know, October, November, and December.
Well, it may go without saying, but let me say thanks again, Devin, for taking part in this podcast series.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thanks also in order for Serena Higgins, who was brave enough to accept the challenge to co-host with me and even take the lead on the last show. Thanks, Serena.
Oh, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And tell us one last time where people can find you online and what listeners can expect when visiting your site.
There are two places to find me online. Both can be found by Googling the phrase iambic admonit, iambicadmonit, my blog where I write about faith and the arts and the inklings, and also my website where I have lots of inklings links.
And in case you've forgotten who I am, my name is William O'Flaherty, and I'm the producer of these shows and other interviews you can get at EssentialCSLewis.com, where you also find other interesting content, including daily quizzes and facts about C.S. Lewis. I mentioned this last time, but let me note as we close out that starting in 2013, if you're listening to this before that time, I'll be doing a weekly series sharing information about Lewis based on what was happening in his life during a particular week. Over the course of his life, so like the first week of January, during from when he was born to before he died, what happened during that time, and whether it's his works or something that happened in his life, and so a variety of things to write about. I hope you will check that out as well. And I hope you have enjoyed this series dealing with the Christian world of The Hobbit. And again, we encourage you to check out Devin Brown's book, The Christian World of The Hobbit.